Haley? As soon as I saw her crossing the bar's threshold, I couldn't help but utter her name. My heart sank as her arm was linked to a stranger, a man I had never seen before. How could she have found someone else so quickly? After all, we had only broken up 3 days ago. I had come to the bar alone to drown my sorrows, but now that I had seen her, it was as if my mind had been spoiled. I tried to stay out of her sight while watching her laugh and flirting with her new companion, but no matter how much I tried, I couldn't control my jealousy and anger. Seeing her giggling and having fun with another man was tearing me apart. I was on the verge of walking over to their table and calling her out, but I managed to control myself. As I watched her from afar, I couldn't help but wonder if she had been seeing this man all along while we were still together. Was he the reason why she had called off our relationship? Looking at her now, I couldn't shake off the feeling that I had been betrayed. My fists clenched tightly, and I was filled with an overwhelmingly sense of frustration when I saw him tenderly kissing her hands, and she blushed a deep shade of red. He leaned in and whispered something in her ear, causing her to nod enthusiastically while her cheeks turned a deeper shade of crimson, the expression only I was allowed to see before. He rose from his seat and sauntered to the bar counter to order drinks while booking an apartment on Airbnb. I was sitting right beside them, filled with a mixture of anger and helplessness. I longed to give him a piece of my mind, but I knew I had no right to interfere anymore. My heart was racing as I sat in the dimly lit bar, the clinking of glasses and chatter of patrons fading into the background. My eyes were fixed on the woman I had been dating for months, now chatting with another man across the room. A wave of emotions flooded my mind, a mix of betrayal, confusion, and anger. My thoughts raced as I wondered if she had been seeing him behind my back. I felt torn between the urge to confront her, to demand answers, and to know the truth, and the impulse to simply leave and forget about the whole thing. As I stood up to walk out, my legs felt heavy, as if weighed down by the weight of my disappointment. The sound of my footsteps echoed in the emptying bar, each step a reminder of the pain I was feeling. I couldn't help but feel defeated and sad as I left the bar, the memories of our once love now tainted by the possibility of infidelity. As I sat inside my car ready to start, I caught sight of the two of them walking into the parking lot. It was apparent that they were now heading back. However, my attention was drawn to their intimate moment as he suddenly pulled her close, wrapping his arms around her waist and pressing her up against the wall. I couldn't tear my eyes away, even though I felt frustrated with myself for staring. Their kiss seemed to go on forever, and I couldn't help but feel like an intruder in their private moment. Eventually, she whispered something in his ear, and they broke apart, heading to a nearby car and driving off. My curiosity piqued, and I remembered seeing him book an apartment, and I couldn't resist the urge to follow them. I don't know why I did it, but I felt like I needed to find out more about the relationship. The one-story building that Haley and the mysterious man entered was nondescript, with peeling paint and a rusted sign that read, "Vacancy." I parked my car at a safe distance and watched their movements, trying to make sense of their actions. Despite my initial doubts, I attempted to sneak inside and finally managed to infiltrate the building, though it took me some time to find an entrance. While I tiptoed through the dimly lit hallways, my senses were on high alert, and I could feel my heart pounding in my chest. Suddenly, I heard the unmistakable sound of the man's moans emanating from one of the rooms. The sound was muffled but distinct, and seemed to be coming from a bedroom. I hesitated momentarily, unsure if I should investigate further. But curiosity got the better of me. I inched closer to the room, my footsteps barely making a sound. As I got closer, the moans turned into ear-piercing screams, which were silenced almost as quickly as they began. I was taken aback and confused by the sudden change in noise, so I leaned in to take a closer look. What I saw made my blood run cold and my spine tingle with horror. The bed was in disarray, with blood everywhere. The man lay in the center of the bed, his throat ripped apart, with Haley on top of him. Her eyes were black with no pupil or iris in sight, and blood dripped through her sharp teeth, which didn't look human, as she watched the man with a bloodthirsty stare. Her glowing skin had turned pale and sickly looking, sending shivers to my bones. My breath got stuck in my throat as I saw her ripping off his flesh monstrously. I couldn't believe my eyes that it was the same girl whom I had been kissing and sleeping with for the past 6 months. There was no way it was Haley. I could hear my mind urging me to run away from that place, and that was what I did. My legs didn't stop till I reached my car and got in. Without a second thought, I drove away from that place. My heart kept pounding as the flashes of what I saw kept replaying in my mind like a horror movie. After blocking Haley from everywhere and deleting her number, I returned to my life and tried to live as normally as possible. But after what I witnessed that day, I couldn't do that, since there was no way my life could return to normal. I know no one would ever believe me if I told them, but I can't remove those images from my mind that kept lingering inside. All these nightmares are making me feel like I'm losing my mind, and no matter how hard I try, I'm unable to forget her. Not because I love her or anything, but because I got to know that the girl I dated is a monster. Last year, after losing my job, my girlfriend of 5 years, and all hope in the town I was living in, I decided to pack up my life and move to Boston for a fresh start. Though I didn't know anyone there, I knew I could find a new job and a place there from the decent chunk of money I had saved to buy the diamond ring of her dreams to propose to her. I booked a flight ticket and hopped on the plane for my new life ahead, hoping it would be better than my previous one. I wasn't very enthusiastic, though, since all I was looking for was an escape from the nightmarish reality of everything that had happened in the past few months. When planning a fresh start, I should have been more careful and detailed, because after 2 days of landing in Boston and staying in a hotel, I realized finding an apartment wasn't as easy as I thought. I looked in quite a few places through websites and apps, only to find out that they all had steep credit score requirements. But since I was desperate to find a place soon, I decided to try Airbnb. I intensely scoured through the website and contacted many listings, only to get a negative response each time. After about a day with no luck, I was about to give up and move to a different site when my fingers stopped scrolling at one particular listing. It said that she had a 2-story house in a safe neighborhood and wanted to rent it out. The pricing was relatively cheap for the photo she had posted, but since I wasn't in the place to be choosy, I decided to contact the woman and see if she could let me rent it. Judging by my 5-minute conversation, she seemed friendly and polite. She suggested that we meet at the house, so she could show me the place and talk about renting it only after I like it. I agreed and we decided to meet upon the next day's afternoon. Nothing seemed sketchy till this point, and I felt a bit nervous and excited, thinking I might finally be able to get a place. I was simultaneously going for job interviews while looking for apartments, and that evening, I got a response from one of the companies informing me that I got the position. The next afternoon, I got ready in a nice t-shirt and pants and headed to the address she had given me. As I entered the neighborhood, I realized the word safe in the advertisement was false, since there were all kinds of junkies and suspicious-looking people roaming around the area. I still thought it probably wasn't as bad as it seemed and continued walking until I reached the expected house. It seemed grand and impressive from the outside, which put me at ease. I thought it was just the neighborhood she lied about, and probably everything else was fine. However, as I waited outside for the woman to arrive, my sense of unease only grew. When she finally arrived 30 minutes late, I was taken aback by her disheveled appearance. It seemed she had just awakened from sleep and didn't even bother changing before heading here. It took me a moment to regain my composure and speak to her. Unlike how we talked over the phone, Her personality felt a bit creepy. Through the gate of the house's entry door, she rambled nonstop about herself and how great her place was until a bat flew over our head with a screeching sound. As soon as I set foot inside the house, my heart sank. It was nothing like the pictures that were advertised. The low price suddenly made sense. Those photos must have been taken years ago when the house was in better condition. But now, it was a different story. It was muddy, dirty, and completely unlivable. Spiderwebs clung to every corner of the room, and I couldn't help but feel a shiver crawl down my spine. It quickly became apparent that there was no electricity. The taps produced only muddy, murky water, which was unusable. But the woman showing me around had an explanation for everything. She insisted that the place would look great after cleaning and furnishing it. As she continued to talk, I couldn't help but feel more and more uneasy. She started telling me about her personal life and how she had a grudge against her neighbor because of their dog. The dog would ruin her lawn daily, and she was justifiably angry. But I wasn't interested in listening. All I wanted was to get out of there as quickly as possible. I breathed a sigh of relief when my phone rang, and I saw the name of one of my older colleagues flash on the screen. Using it as an excuse, I hastily exited the house, claiming I had somewhere to be. As I walked toward the bus stop while conversing over the phone, trying to shake off the anxiety building up inside me, I felt another set of footprints walking behind me. I turned around, only to be horrified, seeing she followed me with a weird smile.
"Oh, don't mind me. Keep walking. I just wanted to walk with you to the bus stop now that we would be living nearby."
Goosebumps erupted all over my body by her words. But despite the fear gnawing at me, I didn't say a word and continued walking. The moment I got to the bus stop, I noticed a bus standing there, which wasn't going to my stop, but trying to escape the uncomfortable and creepy situation, I boarded it. She stood there watching with that constant creepy smile as the bus moved forward. I got off at the next stop and got the bus that was supposed to take me to my destination. I had made up my mind that I wouldn't use Airbnb to find an apartment anymore and contacted a realtor instead, something I should have done before. She tried calling me multiple times, but I blocked her. Though I was able to find a place within a week with the help of the realtor and even started my job, my phone would still ring once in a while with an unknown number flashing on my screen each time, causing me dread. I would block it instantly and pray that I never see her again.
Hey guys, thanks so much for all the support. If you haven't subscribed to the channel yet, please feel free to do so.
On 620 South Main Street of Los Angeles, California, sits a rather unassuming-looking hotel. Opened on December 20th of 1924, the 19-story, 700-room hotel had recently undergone something of a makeover. It's now known as the Stay on Main, and has been undergoing renovations for the last few years, and is due to open again in October of 2021. But whether or not the hotel will see many bookings is anyone's guess, as the place has, shall we say, a rather dark past. You see, for almost 100 years, the Stay on Main was known as the Cecil Hotel, and it's most famous for being the site of an inordinate number of murders, people taking their own lives, and otherwise unexplainable deaths. In the early 1920s, American hoteliers William Hanner, Charles Dix, and Robert Shops pulled together their capital and opened the Cecil as ideal accommodation for travelers and tourists alike. Designed and constructed in the Beaux Arts style, the hotel boasted an opulent marble lobby with stained glass windows, potted palms, and alabaster statuary. Each of the hoteliers brought a vast amount of business acumen to the table, and it seemed the Cecil was destined to be a roaring success. But within 5 years of its grand opening, America would plunge into financial ruin, as Wall Street would bring one of the darkest days in U.S. stock market history. It's little surprise that this tumultuous event is the thing that seems to have preceded such a morbid decline. But even for such a depressing period of history, The Cecil seems to have been the center of some kind of grim maelstrom, as the deaths came thick and fast from then on. In November of 1931, 46-year-old W.K. Norton took his own life by ingesting poison. A week prior, he had checked into the Cecil under the guise of a man named James Willis from Chicago. It's not certain why Norton took his own life, but it's been commonly speculated that it was related to the financial crisis of the previous 2 years. Less than a year later, in September of 1932, 25-year-old Benjamin Dottich shot himself in the head while sitting on a Cecil hotel bed. A maid found his body the following morning, but again, it's not clear why the young man decided to take his own life, as he neglected to leave a note. In late July of 1934, former Army Medical Corps Sergeant Louis D. Borden checked into a room at the Cecil, only to slash his own throat with a straight razor in the hotel bathroom. Yet unlike the previous two, the 53-year-old left several notes, one of which cited poor health as the reason for his actions. A tragic yet perfectly understandable reason to take your own life, but just as terrifying and bizarre, was that he too should gravitate to the Cecil in the final hours of his life. In the decade that followed, many more of these unexplained deaths would occur, around a third of them involving military men. But the nature of the deaths at the Cecil would not evolve until September of 1944, when a young woman named Dorothy Jean Purcell seemed to be overcome with a temporary but terrible madness. Dorothy had booked a stay at the Cecil with her 38-year-old boyfriend, Ben Levine. All was well until the middle of the night when Dorothy awoke in terrible pain. She soon realized that what she was experiencing was contractions and that she was going into labor. Terrified and confused, she dragged herself into the hotel bathroom, quietly giving birth to a tiny baby boy. Dorothy later claimed that she had no idea she was even pregnant, and as such, she'd done absolutely no research into what to expect. According to her, the baby was silent as the grave, leading her to believe that it was some kind of stillbirth. Yet, instead of waking her boyfriend or calling for help, Dorothy Purcell opened up the bathroom window as quietly as she could, then tossed her infant son out into the night. The deceased child was later found on the roof of an adjacent building, yet it was determined that the child had still been alive at the time it had been thrown from the hotel window. Naturally, there was a palpable level of public outrage once the story graced local newspapers and Dorothy Purcell was tracked down and arrested on suspicion of murder. However, after being psychoanalyzed by not one, but three psychiatrists, Dorothy was determined to be mentally confused at the time of the birth and was acquitted in January of 1945 by reason of insanity. By all accounts, she'd had no history of mental health problems prior to checking into the Cecil and had absolutely no explanation for the event itself. It seems like a horrible coincidence that such a thing would occur while staying at the Cecil Hotel. But the question remains, were there other forces at work which induced both Dorothy's labor and the so-called confused state that followed? Between 1944 and 1962, a handful of other people took their own lives at the Cecil Hotel, all of them involving death by falling. One of these was particularly gruesome, given that it didn't just take one life, but two. On October 12th of 1962, 27-year-old Pauline Otten jumped from the window of her ninth-floor room after an argument with her estranged husband, Dewey, who had stormed out of the suite just moments before. In a sickening twist of fate, Pauline landed on a passing pedestrian, 65-year-old George Giannini, with the impact killing them both instantly. As there were no witnesses, police initially believed that Pauline and George had taken their life together, possibly as some kind of bizarre death pact. However, it was soon determined that not only was Giannini wearing shoes at the time of his death, he also had his hands in his pockets. Had he jumped, his shoes would have likely fallen off during the fall or upon impact, and his hands would have definitely not have remained in his pockets. It's quite incredible that such an unfortunate event could even occur. There was literally not another soul on the street that day, and Pauline just so happened to land perfectly atop her unlikely victim. Again, is this purely coincidence, or was there something else at work that day? The next bizarre death to occur at the Cecil was that of 65-year-old retired telephone operator Goldie Osgood. Osgood was well known around the area and had earned the nickname of Pigeon Goldie because she fed birds in nearby Pershing Square. She was a regular sight around the square, perennially sporting the LA Dodgers baseball that she seemed to cherish so dearly. But on June 4th of 1964, a member of the Cecil's housekeeping staff entered Goldie's room to find the place had been ransacked. Birdseed was scattered all over the room, something Goldie carried around everywhere with her. And her beloved LA Dodgers cap was lying in a pool of blood, just feet away from her lifeless corpse. She had been beaten, carnally violated, and then stabbed almost 30 times with a large serrated knife. Just hours after her murder, 29-year-old Jacques Ellinger was spotted walking through Pershing Square with his clothes absolutely soaked in blood. This is at a time when DNA analysis hadn't been invented yet, but since there was a literal trail of blood from Goldie's hotel room to Pershing Square, it was pretty easy to deduce that Jacques had been Goldie's killer. But this is where things get weird. Despite the killing being connected to a handful of other murders in the area, Jacques claimed that he had no memory of any murder and had in fact blacked out for a few hours, led to police dropping all charges against him. What should have been an open and shut case was muddied and crippled by some mysterious internal or external influence, and once again, the Cecil Hotel was inextricably involved somehow. Two more mysterious deaths by falling occurred at the Cecil in the years 1975 and 1992. But perhaps the most famous of all the Cecil's enigmatic deaths is that of 21-year-old Canadian college student Elisa Lamb. Enrolled at the University of British Columbia, Elisa decided to do a post-Christmas trip down to California in early 2013. She traveled solo via Amtrak and inner-city buses, taking time out to visit the San Diego Zoo and eventually arriving safely in LA on January 26th. 2 days later, she checked into the Cecil Hotel, opting for one of the hotel's cheaper shared rooms on its fifth floor. However, just a day or two into her stay, her impromptu roommates began to complain that Elisa was exhibiting some rather off behavior. As a result, hotel staff decided to move Elisa into her own private room at no extra cost. It's worth noting at this stage that Elisa had been previously diagnosed with both depression and bipolar disorder, and was taking 4 separate medications to combat the symptoms. However, not a single member of her family said that she had any history whatsoever of any thoughts of taking her own life. According to them, Elisa had her own struggles, but she determined to conquer adversity and lead a happy, productive life. Yet they did admit to one incident in which Elisa had gone missing for a brief period of time. Naturally, her parents were mildly concerned about her well-being during a solo trip down to Cali and asked Elisa to check in with them every day she was there. Elisa was only too happy to comply and called daily to share travel stories and swap I love yous. However, on February 1st of 2013, the very same day she was due to check out of the Cecil, her daily phone call didn't come. Elisa's parents grew increasingly worried until eventually they contacted the LAPD to report Elisa missing. Police jumped into action, driving down to the Cecil to question hotel staff. A number of the housekeeping team had seen Elisa on the day she disappeared, reporting that she was alone and that nothing seemed out of the ordinary. Police also spoke to the manager of a nearby bookstore that Elisa frequented during her stay, who told them Elisa was outgoing, lively, and very friendly, talking about what books she was getting and whether or not what she was getting would be too heavy for her to carry around as she traveled. In short, it's clear that Elisa was suffering from poor mental health, at least during the morning anyway. As a follow-up, police searched the Cecil and the surrounding area as best they could, using sniffer dogs and helicopter support. But given that no foul play was suspected, the LAPD was unable to search the entire hotel, leaving one detective with the terrible feeling that they were just inches away from finding a girl that was in grave and mortal danger. On February 6th of 2013, a week after she was last spotted, the LAPD circulated flyers with Elisa's image and brought the case to the public's attention through local media outlets. Just over a week later, having still made no progress in the case, LAPD released footage of Lamb's last known sighting, taken from an elevator surveillance camera on February 1st. The roughly 3-minute video shows a solitary Elisa making unusual movements and gestures while appearing to hide in the elevator. It also appears as if Elisa was trying to get the elevator car to move in order to escape from someone who was pursuing her. Some speculated that the bout of paranoia may have been the result of her ingesting some kind of party drug, such as MDMA, while others suggest her behavior was that of a textbook psychotic episode. Yet perhaps the most disturbing suggestion was from a self-proclaimed video editing expert, who asserted that the CCTV footage had been tampered with before being released to the general public. Besides the obvious obscuring of the timestamp, this expert claimed that not only had parts of the footage been deliberately slowed down, but almost an entire 60 seconds of the footage had been erased. If this is true, it's fairly obvious why this might be done, and that's to protect the identity of someone who happened to appear in the video. Yet at the same time, could it be to protect the person responsible for Elisa's disappearance? 19 days after Elisa initially went missing, guests at the Cecil Hotel began to complain of low water pressure in their faucets and showers. This was on top of existing complaints that there was a weird taste and color to the tap water. So in the morning of February 19th, a hotel maintenance worker took the stairs up to the hotel's roof, intending to inspect the 4,000-gallon tanks that supplied the hotel's water. 3 of the 4 tanks were completely clear of any debris or blockages. But upon opening the fourth, the maintenance worker let out a blood-curdling scream as he was faced with the bloated, decomposing body of none other than Elisa Lamb. 2 days later, the LA coroner's office released a statement saying that the cause of Elisa's death was accidental drowning, adding that her bipolar disorder played a significant factor in her untimely demise. Although the clothes she'd been wearing in the elevator CCTV footage were found in the tank with her, she had apparently been stripped naked at some point, with a sand-like substance covering the parts of her body that weren't submerged in the water. This sand-like substance was never identified, and there remains intense speculation as to what it might have been. Analysis of Elisa's body showed that there was no evidence of physical trauma, carnal assault, or her taking her own life. Toxicology tests showed traces of the prescription medication she was using, along with a very small amount of alcohol, but no traces of other recreational drugs could be found in her bloodstream. The amount of prescription medication was found to be slightly less than the effective dose, yet experts believe this wasn't low enough to spark off any kind of psychotic episode and dismiss this as being to blame for Elisa's death. All of these details certainly make for an intensely morbid mystery. Perhaps one of the most confounding aspects of the case is just how Elisa got into the water tank in the first place. You see, most of the doors and staircases that led to the hotel's roof were supposedly locked at the time the young Canadian disappeared, and only members of staff have the passcodes and keys to these passages. Any attempt to force them would have triggered an alarm at the hotel front desk, maybe even a hotel-wide fire alarm if any of the entrances were fire doors. Surely it's entirely possible that the hotel's fire escape would allow her to reach the roof unimpeded, but sniffer dogs only followed her scent about halfway up the staircase, then indicated that she must have used an open window to scramble onto the roof instead of the door, which was just feet away. On top of that, all 4 tanks were 4x8-foot cylinders propped up on concrete blocks, meaning there was no fixed access to them and hotel workers had to use a ladder to get a look at the water. Each was protected by heavy steel lids that would be extremely difficult to properly replace from within. Essentially, all of this pointed to the idea that someone, or something, had somehow killed Elisa and disposed of her body in the water tank, all without being detected by any of the hotel's security cameras. Of all the mysterious deaths that occurred at the Cecil Hotel, Elisa's gives us the most detailed and intimate look into what kind of fate might have befallen them. It's clear that over the years, many of the hotel guests had suffered psychotic episodes or blackouts during their stays, and at a rate far higher than any other hotel in the country. And in spite of the fact that these deaths have been occurring for almost 100 years, were still no closer to offering up concrete explanations for their untimely demises. Perhaps all of the murders, people taking their own life, and enigmatic deaths have perfectly reasonable and logical explanations to them, explanations that modern science would quite easily have explained. But perhaps there's something more sinister at work here, that the truth behind the Cecil is more akin to Stephen King's The Shining than we'd ever be comfortable admitting to ourselves.